So let's see if this works. Okay, looks good. Okay, so thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's an honor to be giving the first talk in this very exciting conference. So today I want to tell you about some of the recent advances that we've seen over the last year or so in our understanding of non-invertible symmetries in dimensions greater than 2. So because it's the first talk, I don't want to go, 0 to 60 right out the door. So I'm going to begin just with a brief review of these recent results. That'll be the first third of the talk. And then in the second and third thirds of the talk, I want to tell you about some more recent work and also some upcoming work. Okay, so the whole thing won't just be review, but the beginning portion will be. Okay, and let's see. Can I see this? Yes. All right. So let me begin with a brief overview of things. So I think we all are well aware that symmetries have long been a guiding principle in theoretical physics. And just within the last decade or so, our understanding of symmetries has really seen a renaissance. So we now have all of these really nice, fancy extensions of the notion of a symmetry to things like higher form symmetry, vector multiple symmetry, subsystem symmetries, as well as non-invertible symmetries. And the sort of conceptual breakthrough that's made all of these things possible is the realization that symmetries should be thought of as synonymous with topological defects. Okay, so for every topological defect, well, first of all, for every symmetry, there's some corresponding topological defect that implements that symmetry, such that if you drag operators in your theory past the defect, you get an action of the symmetry. But conversely, for every topological defect, there should also be some corresponding symmetry. And so sometimes these topological defects have some funny fusion rules, which is not group-like, and then the symmetry that you'll get out is not a group, it's something more general. We'll see examples of that. So this conference, its main focus is global categorical symmetries. That's the name of the collaboration. And this, in my mind, is basically synonymous with non-invertible. So you can throw the higher forms in there as well, but the non-invertibility is what gives rise to this categorical here. So that's going to be the main focus of the talk. Okay, so in two dimensions, non-invertible symmetries are actually fairly well understood. Okay, and in two dimensions, it's known that these symmetries form a fusion category. Well, all symmetries form a fusion category, but in particular, the non-invertible ones do as well. So the fusion category is some math structure which has some objects in it. And the objects you should think of as the topological defects which implement the symmetry. Okay, so in the 2D example, these would be lines. Okay, so insofar as the physicist is concerned, the fusion category par excellence is the Ising category. This is a fusion category with three simple lines. Have the identity line, this eta line, and n here. And here's the fusion ring of this category. So this is how these lines fuse together. So eta squares to 1, which means that it generates some Z2 symmetry. N squares to 1 plus eta, and n can absorb eta. You see, among other things, that there's no inverse of n. There's nothing that when I multiply it against n, I just get 1. Hence, we would say that n generates a non-invertible symmetry. Okay? Now, the Ising category is a particular example of something more general known as a Tambari-Yamagami category. So Tambari-Yamagami categories are labeled by some group G, just take it to be a discrete group. And the fusion ring for this category is as shown here. So I have a bunch of group-like lines which fuse in some manner which is dictated by the group multiplication. And then I have precisely one non-invertible line, which squares to the sum of all of the group-like lines. Okay, so this is like the simplest thing past just a normal group category. And we can see that the Ising category, or at least the Ising fusion rules, is a subset of these when G is equal to Z2. Okay? Now, I think both physicists and mathematicians really like the Tambari-Yamagami categories because they're so simple. From a mathematician's point of view, these things, you know, a long time ago, people did some fancy operations, like they could do the Drinfeld center of this thing explicit and find the S and T matrices of the Drinfeld center, so that's nice. For the physicist, why do they like Tambari-Yamagami categories? Well, one reason is that Tambari-Yamagami categories encode something about dualities under gauging a symmetry G. Okay. Dualities is going to be sort of one of the underlying themes of this overview portion of the talk. So let me just give you a quick pictorial argument for why Tambari-Yamagami categories have anything to do with duality. Okay. And by duality, let me say that I mean that the theory will be self-dual under gauging this discrete symmetry G. Okay, so here's a quick pictorial argument for why there might be some connection here. So let's consider the torus partition function of a theory. And I drew it as this box here. Then I can go ahead and if I have this Tambari-Yamagami extension of my group, so if I have this non-invertible line N, I can nucleate a little bubble of it. Okay? I can always shrink this away at the cost of producing some factors, so this is fine. And now I can deform this bubble, okay, because one of the crucial properties of these defects is that they're topological. So I can just deform this line in this way at no cost. And now in this region here, as well as this top region, this right region, the bottom region, I can use these fusion rules to replace these two ends with a sum over these group-like lines. And if I shrink the bubble away, I'll get this picture here, which is precisely the G-gauged torus partition function. But at least at this pictorial level, we can see that because I had this line N, the original torus partition function and the G-gauged torus partition function are the same. Okay, so this is a... Yes? Should I just repeat the question? Okay. So the question was, does G have to be abelian? And for our purposes, I will take G to be abelian, yes. Great. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So thanks a lot. Good. So this is just a brief review of 2D. The main focus of today's talk will be 4D. So I now want to just jump right into to higher dimensions. Okay. Yes. Okay, the question was, what is duality? What I mean by duality here, well, there's various things you can mean by duality, and it's not always what I'm going to say. But what I mean here by duality is that if I take the theory, and then I do some other so right now I'm saying that the theory and the G-gauged theory are dual. What that means is that there's basically some isomorphism from every quantity you can compute in one theory to every quantity you can compute in the other. Every correlator that you can compute, every physical quantity has some counterpart. The isomorphism is not always trivial. So it could be some non-trivial map between the quantities, and we'll see that when I give an explicit example of S-duality in gauge theories. But yeah, you should think of it as just some isomorphism between every quantity in one theory and every quantity. Great. Okay, thanks. Good. So let me get to higher dimensions. So, okay, first I should say that if you're more of a math-oriented person, then there's some words that would immediately come to your mind when you try and go to higher dimensions, which are words like higher fusion category, and these are the things that people have explored and made some progress. For example, I think that fusion two categories are fairly well understood now, though maybe there's still some things that could be desired. But for a physicist, we would just want some concrete examples in higher dimensions, and I would say that until fairly recently, there was no systematic construction of non-invertible defects or duality-type defects in higher dimensions. Okay, so it was really like November of last year where we first had systematic constructions for these sort of things. Though there were some scattered examples before, which were very nice, and there will be some more examples of previous works that I'll put at the bottom of the slide. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about these new higher dimensional non-invertible defects. So thus far, these things fall into two main classes. This is by no means exhaustive. It's not the case that every non-invertible defect in higher dimensions is of these two types. But here's just two nice classes. First of all, condensation defects. The idea here is to take some higher form symmetry and to condense it on some submanifold. So what does that mean? So let me illustrate it by means of an example. Say we're in 4D, so four dimensions, and we consider a one-form symmetry, Zn one-form symmetry. This thing has a corresponding topological defect, which is codimension 2. It's codimension 2 because it's a one-form symmetry. So in 4D, codimension 2 means it's a surface. And now I can go ahead and I can condense the surface on a three-manifold. And what I mean by that is just that I'm going to insert the generators of this Zn one-form symmetry on all of the two cycles of that three-manifold. Yes?
I assume that this is not condensed in the sense of varying some parameter in the Lagrangian and getting something to get an expectation of.
So I think that there is an interpretation in from that point of view, but for our purposes, there isn't, and this is a word that I stole from the condensed matter literature where people talk about condensing anions. We're the same, I think. I mean, yes. Yeah. The terminology here is... Yes. Okay, right. Sorry, let me repeat the question. The question is, why is this called condensed? Can we think of this as varying some parameter and having some VEV of something pop up? And I believe that if you ask Shuhang, he'll say that you can think about it in that terms. But insofar as I think about it, I have borrowed wrong terminology from the condensed matter people who say things like anion condensation. And this is precisely like anion condensation on a submanifold. Except now it's not anions, it's some higher dimensional surface. So all I mean by condensation, when I use it throughout this talk, will just be summing over these insertion of these defects on all of the cycles of the manifold. That's all I mean, yeah. I share the complaint. Okay, any other questions? Okay, great. Good. So, condensation defects. Sorry, I don't remember if I finished saying this. I think I did. So, right. So, what you do is you just insert the generators of this one-form symmetry on all of the cycles of H2 of M3 in Zn, and what you'll get is effectively some defect that lives on the three-manifold. And under favorable circumstances, if you condensed the correct things, then you'll get a non-invertible zero-form symmetry generated by this three-manifold, this codimension one surface. Okay, so this is one example of non-invertible symmetries, and I won't really talk much about this anymore. I think that Shuhang will probably briefly mention this in his talk in a couple of days, so we can look forward to hearing more about that. Okay, so what I'll focus on more today are so-called duality defects. There's also triality defects and more generally n-ality defects. And these things you can think of as like the square root of condensation defects. Okay, in the following sense, so I'll consider codimension one duality defects. So they live on three manifolds in 4D, and I'll call it n. Okay, this is the defect. So this n has the property that n times n bar, its orientation reversal, is, up to some prefactor, precisely this condensate that I had mentioned before. It's precisely this formal sum over lines here. Okay, so these will be really the main focus of the next 10 minutes or so at least. And so I'll give you a little bit more detail about that. But before going on, let me just tell you that this is not an exhaustive list, as I said before. There are non-invertible defects which are not of these types, at least in sufficiently high dimensions. There are things that don't have anything to do with condensation and duality. And there were some examples of this in the previous literature, And in this very nice and impressive paper, they gave many such examples. And I think that Sakura will be talking about this in her talk, so we can look forward to hearing more about that then. And yes?
There's a question in the chat.
Oh, OK, yes.
Great. If you didn't hear that, go ahead and ask the question on chat. I'll read it. So from Zoom, does the self-duality group always come as some stabilizer group at fixed loci of some duality group acting on the theory space?
Oh, I see the question. In all of the examples, that's how it happens. And I would suspect that that is all, so I don't have to repeat that question, right? Everybody heard. OK, yes. So I think that that is the case. So for example, well, we will see examples of precisely that, where in general, you have dualities that map between different theories. In other words, originally, you have not a defect, but rather an interface between two separate theories. And then you go to some fixed points where that interface actually becomes a defect in a single theory. Yes, so all of the examples that we know of are of that type. Great question. OK, good. So let me tell you a little bit more about duality defects now. So there are two approaches to constructing duality defects that we know of. One is an approach via anomalies. In this approach, you start with a theory with an invertible symmetry G and another invertible symmetry, H. So there's only invertible symmetries in the game. But G and H have some mixed anomaly of a certain type. And the mixed anomaly is such that when I gauge H, then naturally I won't have G anymore. But G will survive in some guise as some non-invertible symmetry. Okay. So this is one approach. You start with just invertible symmetries. You gauge part of the symmetry. The other part becomes non-invertible. A related approach is via half-space gauging. The idea here is to start with a theory, again, with some invertible symmetry, and then to gauge that invertible symmetry in half of the space. Okay? And so this is a picture that I took from this paper here. So on this side, I have the ungauged theory, T, on the left. On the right, I've gauged this symmetry in half of the space. And now I'm going to put some Dirichlet boundary conditions at this interface here to get a topological interface. Okay. So this thing is topological, and it's an interface. Okay. It's a, as I was just saying, it's an interface between two separate theories. Okay. It's not a defect in a single theory. But in the case where the theory is actually self-dual, then this right-hand side is the same as this left-hand side. And then this interface actually becomes a defect in a single theory. Okay. So this is an idea that we'll explore in more examples in a second. But does that make sense? You gauge in half of the space, and you look for a theory which is self-dual. That will give you a defect of this type. And this defect will generate some non-invertible symmetry. OK. So these two approaches here, anomalies and half-space gauging, are closely related. They have a lot of overlap, but they're not identical. And in particular, I'll eventually tell you that there are some non-invertible defects you can get via half-space gauging that don't come from anomalies. Yes?
If the theory is self-dual, why does that guarantee that basically anything should be happening at all? Why does it guarantee that the defect line is non-invertible?
OK. So the question was, how do I know that this defect line is going to be non-invertible? And the answer is that we know how to compute its fusion rules. So you can just explicitly compute the fusion rules. This is an exercise which is done in this paper, and also from a different point of view in this paper. And you'll get basically exactly these fusion rules. You just explicitly do it. Like, you can write down the action for the theory that lives on the defects, or the action of the theory in the presence of the defects, and you just compute it, and you'll get this, which is a sum of stuff, so it's non-invertible.
OK. screen. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, great. Okay. Good, very good. So let me give you a concrete example now. Oh, yes. Sorry, oh, the question was the question, what happens if it's a spin theory? Okay, so yeah, you can do the same thing in a spin theory as well. And in fact, in our original case, we did it only in the spin case. It's actually the non-spin case where you have to have some modifications to at least the original thing we did. Like local fermion? Like, this won't do anything. Well, so here in 4D, I'm gauging a one-form symmetry. So to the local operators, like supercharges or fermions, it's not going to do anything. Yeah. Good question. OK, any other questions? OK, great. So example. So let's give an example here. Let's consider SU2 n equals 4 super Yang mills. So maybe some of you are not so familiar with these Suzy gauge theories, but that's OK. The only thing that we really need to know about this SU2 theory is that it has a Z2 one-form symmetry. Okay, it's basically the center symmetry of this SU2. So let's take this Z2 one-form symmetry and let's gauge it in half of the space. Okay, so that's what I did here. So here I have the original SU2 theory at some value of the complex coupling. And then I gauged the one-form symmetry, I'm going to call that gauging operation sigma in half of the space. So that's this red thing. It turns out that it's known that this theory here on the right is something called SO3 plus super Yang mills. And it'll be at the same value of the complex coupling tau Yang mills. The point is that these two theories are not in general the same. For generic tau Yang mills, these are two different theories, and so this sigma gives not a defect in a single theory, but rather an interface between two different theories. However, there's a special value of tau Yang mills, namely tau Yang mills is equal to I, where the theory on the left and the right are the same. And this is a result of something known as S-duality. So it's known that the SO3 plus theory at some value of tau Yang mills is the same as the SU2 minus, as the SU2 theory at a different value of tau Yang mills, minus 1 over tau Yang mills. Okay, this is a statement of some isomorphism between these two theories. Non-trivial isomorphism, which I'll call S, but these theories are physically equivalent. And in particular, we see that when tau Yang mills is equal to I, these two theories are evaluated at the same value of the complex coupling. So in that case, the theory here and the theory here really are the same. In other words, the composite defect sigma S here can be thought of as a defect in a single theory, SU2 at tau Yang mills is equal to I. This gives us our first example of one of these non-invertible defects in this SU2 theory. And it turns out to be a defect of duality type. Okay, good. So I'm going to give you many more examples of these non-invertible defects. So many examples that you're not going to want anymore by the end of this. But before I give you all of those examples, I want to motivate you for why you should care. Okay. So why should we be paying attention to all of this? Well, so why are non-invertible symmetries useful and interesting? First of all, non-invertible symmetries tell you about self-dualities of the theory, okay, in particular the ones of duality type. I basically, this was already implicit in one of the constructions, the half-space gauging. But you could also give an argument that's a lot like that Tambara Yamagami argument I gave in 2D. If you remember that from a few minutes ago, we took this torus partition function, we inserted this N on a contractible cycle and massaged it to make it into an insertion of this so-called condensate, sum over group-like defects, and you can do precisely the same thing here. So this is schematically a picture of putting in this duality defect on all of the elements of H3 of your four manifold, and then using the fusion rules to reduce it to this mesh of the condensate, which implements the gauging. Okay, so this is So duality symmetries tell you about self-dualities. Non-invertible symmetries in general are also nice because they give you constraints on RG flows. Okay, so here's just an example that I'll read off. We won't reuse this, but just so you can see a concrete example of such a constraint, I took this from this paper. So this constraint is the following. A 3 plus 1D bosonic QFT, which is self-dual under gauging the ZN1 form symmetry, in other words, which has one of these duality defects, can flow to a trivially gapped phase only if each prime factor of n is 1 mod 4. Okay, so this is just an example of the sort of claims you can make. You can get some constraints on the IR physics, whether or not a theory is trivially gapped using these things. In fact, recently, it was realized that you can also use these symmetries to make some potential real-world predictions, predictions about electron-positron scattering, about neutral pion decay, and so on. And this will be the subject of Shuheng's talk, so we can all look forward to hearing about that. A third nice application of these non-invertible symmetries is that you can not only constrain known RG flows, but you can also use them to generate completely new RG flows. And in this way, identify new theories that you didn't know about before. And this is now what I want to talk about for the next third of the talk. So I'm going to pause and take questions in one slide, but first let me just tell you roughly how we're going to use the non-invertible symmetries to get new RG flows. So in order to do so, let me introduce something which is classic, and people love to do this in studying, say, Suzy gauge theories and stuff like that. So given a d-dimensional theory with a symmetry G, just a normal invertible symmetry, there's a tried and true way of obtaining some new d minus one dimensional theories. And that's known as twisted compactification. So what you do is you put the theory on a circle, so you have md minus one times s1, and you put twisted boundary conditions along the circle. So basically you have your circle, and when you move operators around the circle from theta to theta plus 2 pi, then you can get an action of g. G is some element of this group that you can just choose. Okay, so you put these twisted boundary conditions, and then you reduce on the circle. So effectively, you flow to the IR, you get rid of the KK modes, and you just get a theory which is in d minus 1 dimension, which will be different in general depending on what this g is. Okay, so this is a classic construction. In slightly more modern terms, what this is that you're considering the theory on a circle with the insertion of a codimension 1 defect, which generates this group-like symmetry, at a point on the circle, and which wraps this d minus 1 manifold. And then, as I cross this defect on the circle, I pick up precisely this action of g that I wanted. OK, but once you have this picture, it's of course natural to ask, can I do the same exact thing, but with non-invertible defects? And the answer is yes. And I'd now like to give you a particular example of this, where in the n equals 4 theory, I'll compactify the theory on a circle with twists. And by using non-invertible symmetries to twist by, I'll obtain completely new 3D n equals 6 theories. OK, so that is now what I want to talk about in part 2. Are there any questions before I tell you about this non-invertible twisted compactification? OK, good. So first of all, let me tell you about all of the non-invertible symmetries of n equals 4. And then once we've classified those, I can tell you about compactifying with twists by them. All right, so let's return to this example of SU2 n equals 4 super Yang mills that we discussed. You might remember that we saw that this theory had non-invertible symmetry sigma S, where sigma was gauging of the one-form symmetry, the Z2 one-form symmetry, and S was this S-duality transform. This existed only at the value of the Yang mills, tau Yang mills being I. But this is not the only non-invertible symmetry in this theory. There can be other non-invertible symmetries at different values of tau Yang mills. And now I want to tell you a way to just easily get the full list of these things. This might look pretty roundabout at first, but I think it's probably the most efficient way. So let's just do it. The idea is the following. We first retreat away from the SU2 group to the SU2 algebra. So we think about SU2 algebra super Yang Mills, and we begin by listing all of the global variants of this theory. Okay, so for example, there's some SU2 variant, there should be some SO3 variant, and the SO3 variant can have some discrete theta angles. And so it turns out, this is a classic result, I guess 10 or 9 years ago, that you have three global variants for this theory. The SU2 theory, SO3 plus, SO3 minus. These differ by some discrete theta. So the first step is to just write down all of the global variants and to see how SL2Z acts on them. This is also known from this paper. We had already seen that SU2 and SO3 plus are swapped. But you could ask, how does T act on these? T takes tau Yang Mills to tau Yang Mills plus 1. And it turns out that it maps the SU2 theory to itself. And so this is the diagram. But this diagram is a little bit too rough for our purposes. It's not 100% correct when we couple the theory to background gauge fields for the Z2 one-form symmetry. Okay, and well, how can I see that? So let's start in the SU2 theory and couple to a background gauge field for the Z2 one-form symmetry. I'll call it B2. Well, then, roughly speaking, what you want to do to couple to this is you replace F everywhere with F minus B. That's roughly speaking what you want to do. It's a little more fancy than that. You have to lift F from an SU2 curvature to a U2 curvature and impose this, but we don't have to worry about that for now. So schematically, you just replace F with F minus B. That's how you couple to this gauge field. And so in particular, my action will have a term that looks like this. And so this is this. The theta angle term becomes this. And this, in particular, contains a piece that looks like the Pointer-Hagen square of B. And if you don't know what the Pointer-Hagen square is, don't worry about it. It's just B, wedge B, roughly speaking. Okay. So you have a term that looks like this. So the point here is just that when I couple to this background gauge field for B, and I do this T transformation, which takes theta to theta plus 2 pi, I should produce this counter term here, this invertible phase. And so T should not map the SU2 theory to itself, but rather to itself stacked with this invertible phase. So what I get is a diagram that looks like this. Here's my original SU2 theory, and it had zero factors of the counter term. And then I do T, and I get the SU2 theory stacked with one factor of the counter term. Okay, and so that's what the subscript means. And it turns out that the counter term is just a mod 2. So if I do T again, I go back. Okay. The rest of the diagram is pretty much the same as before, right? So I have S here and T here. And the only other thing that's new is that here S has to take the SO3 minus theory with zero factors of the counter term to the SO3 minus theory with one factor. Just do this at the level of the action, or you can just see that you need ST cubed to be equal to 1. Okay. So remember, our goal is to find non-invertible symmetries. And here I'm just drawing some diagrams. So why am I doing this? Before I answer that, we have to do one more step. We take this diagram, and we introduce two other operations to it. We introduce sigma and tau. Sigma I had already introduced before. This is the operation of gauging the Z2 one-form symmetry. And what's tau? Not to be confused with tau Yang Mills, the coupling. So tau here is an operation where I just stack with this counter term. That's really easy. It turns out that these two transformations, sigma and tau, generate SL2Z2. Okay, so I go ahead and I figure out how this acts on all of the theories here. So clearly tau just maps you between the cases with and without the counter term. That's easy. The sigmas are a little bit more fancy. But they're also straightforward to check. And I was thinking of giving you the full derivation of one of these, but that's not going to happen. So I'm going to skip this. And if you have questions about how one actually derives these sort of things, then please ask after, and I'd be happy to go through this in detail. Like, I really put it in the slides in gory detail. So, but they're all straightforward computations. So anyways, you get a diagram that looks like this. And now I can finally tell you why we did all of this. So how is this related to non-invertible symmetries? Well, once you have this diagram, if you want to find non-invertible symmetries, all you have to do are look for closed loops. Right? So let's start with the SU20 theory. Starting here, obviously S sigma is a closed loop. Right? S sigma. So it takes the theory back to itself, up to the action of S on tau Yang mills. So that means that at the fixed point of S, then I get precisely a symmetry S sigma, which is the one I had identified before. And I can, of course, do this for all of the nodes now. So I could start with this SU2 stacked with the counterterm, and then obviously I can do tau S sigma tau. Here I could do tau S, and so on and so forth. Both invertible and non-invertible symmetries from this diagram. Of course, S sigma is not the only closed loop starting from SU20. Starting from SU20, I could also do T S tau sigma. And that will give me another symmetry. So this thing maps the theory to itself up to the operation of ST on tau. So if I go to the fixed point of ST, then this is some non-invertible symmetry as well. Okay? So this is how you can use this diagram to get non-invertible symmetries. You have to work modulo the trivial closed loops, like sigma tau cubed is equal to 1 and S tau cubed is equal to 1, but besides that, it's very easy now. Okay, so this is the strategy that we can use in general, not just for SU2 super Yang mills, but for generic gauge algebra. You just list the global variance, you draw the diagram, and you look for non-trivial closed loops. So this is really an exercise that you could and maybe even should just have a grad student do, but me and my collaborators don't have grad students yet, so we did it ourselves. And so together with Gabby Zafrir and Yunxin Zheng, we did this exercise for all of the gauge algebras and global variance in super Yang mills, including the exceptionals and the non-simply laced cases. And you know, it's conceptually very straightforward, though in practice it gets sort of ugly. So for example, you know, you get diagrams like this. So there's a lot of global variance, and I had to split up the S and T and sigma tau transformations because they were just too ugly. But anyways, you get some diagram like this. And then from this, you look for closed loops, and you get nice tables like this, where you have the theories here, and then you have the corresponding defects and whether or not, whether they're dualities or trialities. Yes?
You can hear me, no? OK, good. So you can get also higher nullity defects in this construction. I would expect you could do four, like quadrality and exality, maybe, like the finite order elements in PSL in SL2.
Ah, okay, very good question. So yes, so actually, whenever I write nullity of 2 here, it involves S, and so in particular for generic, you know, for any case other than SU2, basically, S doesn't square to 1. It's fourth to 1, right? Because it squares to this complex conjugation element. So then precisely, you would expect that these should be actually forality. But you know, in some sense, so we could have written it like that. But in some sense, it's not. Yeah, so in that case, you see, the charge conjugation actually generates an invertible Z2. So instead of being like a quadrality, it's more like a duality extended by an invertible Z2 symmetry. And for that reason, we decided to go with just calling it nullity 2. So yeah, it's like a duality defect extended by an invertible Z2. And likewise for the Z6. So instead, we called it threality.
OK, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. OK.
So how do you know that these defects aren't actually trivial?
Aren't actually trivial. Well, they aren't. Well, we know that they're not trivial because, among other things, we can, you know, compute their fusion rule. We can also know exactly what the. They definitely give some non-trivial map on the spectrum of line operators, which maps the spectrum of line operators to the same spectrum, but with some non-trivial shift of the entire spectrum.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, we know exactly how.
Okay, and you know how to compute that. I see. And then, so the follow-up, Can you describe how different loops interact with each other to at least write down the algebra of that these different loops satisfy?
Okay, great. So yes. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to say it in extremely rigorous math terms, but basically, what you have to do, you can basically just tell your computer to do this. So you look for closed loops, but then modulo two constraints. So one is that you have to quotient out by sigma tau cubed is equal to 1, and st cubed is equal to 1. St cubed is the one of the defining relations. Sorry, st cubed really has to equal c. So you quotient by that, and you also quotient by the corresponding thing for sigma and tau. And you also, if you have one closed loop, you don't repeat that closed loop. So in other words, if you have S sigma, you don't consider S sigma S sigma, which I would just consider as the square of the defect I got from the original.
Wait, sorry, why don't you consider that? And can't you calculate what that does?
Yeah. Okay, so the reason is that, let's say that this S sigma is called N, then 2 times that closed loop would just be N squared. But of course, I mean, so what I do, I use this diagram to first just get the building blocks, and then I can just square N afterwards. So yeah, it's just that trivial thing. Yeah, I don't know if that was sufficient.
Thanks.
Okay, yeah.
Another little question. Also in the simplest example of SU2 anywhere first being a Mills, do you know what are the local operator on which this duality defect cannot non-trivially?
Yes. So basically, so the sigma and tau operations do not act on local operators at all, because sigma is a gauging of a one-form symmetry, and tau is just stacking with some invertible phase. So all action on the local operators would happen at the level of S and T. And then to the degree that we understand the action of S and T on the local operators, which in some cases we know a little bit more than others, like for example, I know how they act on superchargers and stuff like that, then we know. So yeah, it basically just boils down to the usual action of SL2Z.
Okay, but so for example, in this paper about the condensation defects, they claim that at least in topological quantum field theory, all the zero-form symmetry which do not act on local operator come from some condensation. So do you expect that these duality defects also are some kind of condensation or not?
No, these are not condensation defects. I think that statement is also only in 2 plus 1D. But in any case, these are not condensation defects. Because remember, these are supposed to be sort of like the square root of the condensation defects. So yeah, these things are duality defects. They're the sort of second thing that I had listed in that slide. Yes, go for it.
So Yang-Chao Liu on Zoom asks, does the duality line in the 2D criticalizing model also admit a factorization into gauging operation and electromagnetic duality, as in the 4D case?
Well, I wouldn't say electromagnetic duality, so let me think about that question, though. The answer is yes. You can also decompose it into two operations. And at some point, I did even think about this. Yeah, so So in that case, you start with the fermionic theory, which is a Majorana fermion, which has some anomalous chiral symmetry. And then you do a gauging. And then, so that's a good question. The answer is yes, but I can't reproduce it here on the spot. But yeah, basically, you do the Z2 gauging in the Ising model. That would be the analog of the sigma transformation. Gauge the normal Z2 zero-form symmetry. And then there's some other non-trivial isomorphism that you actually have to do, which is like the analog of S. So yes, but sorry, I won't be able to reproduce it on the spot. OK, any other questions here? Yes, OK, yes. Sigma is defined as gauging a one-form symmetry. That's
different one-form symmetry.
Sorry.
It's a different. The way you define it, it acts differently on the different nodes, right?
Yes. That's right.
Okay, so I think it's the case that you can use any one of your generators at every one of the nodes?
Every one of my generators is the question, is there a sigma?
Let me ask it differently.
Okay.
What's the group generated by these? This group has a name. So what is it?
Okay, good question. So it's an extension of...
That's why I asked it.
Yeah, so we actually know what the group
is.
So
to state it more mathematically, my previous question was whether every generator acts on every node is really whether it's a group or a groupoid.
Yes, good question, and it's a groupoid.
It is a groupoid.
Yes. That's a good question. Yeah, great, thank you.
Hello, Maddie. A lot of the ingredients of your construction lift to the 60-to-0 theory, like the S-duality and the different global forms of the group. So does your whole construction lift? I mean, can you see these interfaces from that perspective?
I think that it does work. And if I recall correctly, I heard that Shuhang said that he was thinking about this with his collaborators, maybe. If Shuhang or collaborators are here, maybe they can chime in on it. But it should work exactly in the 2,0 theory as well. And possibly people are thinking about it right now. I think Hotad is shaking his head, so they're probably thinking about it. Okay. Okay. Good. So then, okay, one more. Anomalies between separate nodes? Yes. Sorry, Tuft anomalies between what? Sorry, I didn't quite get it. Sorry, say it one more time.
That if you consider a given SH2 is a symmetry axis, if I take all the set of lines that way.
Yeah. Oh.
Are there anomalies?
Okay. You're saying that, let's say that I look at all of the closed loops, those all correspond to some symmetry. Are there Tuft anomalies between those? Okay, great question. So unfortunately, these symmetries never coexist. So you never have them both at the same time because they're always only at values of Tao Yang mils, which are different. So you never have two at the same value of Tao Yang mils. So yeah, no. Okay, great question. So let's see how I'm doing on time. This was supposed to end at 11, correct? Okay. Okay, so let's say that we classified all of the non-invertible symmetries of Yang mils. Okay, good. So we have tables like this now. This is the set of all of the non-invertible symmetries that we identified. And now we can do the thing that I said before, which is use them for twisted compactification. And here I decided not to go into this in too much detail, because I think this might, you know, maybe some people in the audience don't care about the minutiae of like SUSY, like moduli spaces of vacua for SUSY theories and stuff like that. But there's a really beautiful story here, so if you're interested in hearing more about it, ask me. But for now, I'll just give you this one slide and move on to the third and final topic, which is actually slightly different. But let me just tell you how you use these things to get new theories briefly, and then we'll move on. Okay, so the idea, as I said before, is to put the theory on a circle, S1 here, with the non-invertible defect N. You can choose any of the ones here, just choose your favorite case to study, located at a point on the circle and wrapping this 3-manifold. Okay, so this N here is built out of sigma, tau, S, and T in all of the cases, right? It's just some combination of these things. And remember that sigma and tau do not act on any local operators, right? Sigma gauges a one-form symmetry, tau stacks with some SPT. So that means that in particular, they don't act on the supercharges. And so the action of this N on the supercharges is always of this type here, where all of the supercharges transform in the same way, and you just have some overall phase, which which is dictated by the particular element of SL2. Okay. So if I just do the twisted compactification using N, I'm going to kill all the Susies, right? Because every supercharge transforms. But if I combine the twist by N with the twist by the R symmetry, then we can actually preserve some subset of these supersymmetries. And in particular, if we do it just right, we can preserve 6 out of 8 supercharges. And so long story short, doing the twist in this way gives us new 3D N equals 6 theories with moduli spaces, which are labeled by some exceptional complex reflection groups. If you don't know what that is, then don't worry about it. But suffice it to say that such things were conjectured to exist before, and nobody knew of examples, and we obtained examples using this non-invertible. Okay, so this is a nice example of using these non-invertible symmetries to generate new theories. Okay, so I'm now going to transition to the third part of the talk, which is quicker than the first and the second, so it should be over soon. Are there any questions before that? Okay. Do I have time to do this? Okay, cool. 10 or 12, is that what you said? Got you. Okay, I can do that. Okay, so let me quickly, in 10 minutes, tell you about part 3. It should be quick. So I've told you about the merits. So this is upcoming work. So I've told you by now about all of these nice merits of non-invertible symmetries and how we can use them to do various things. But in the back of your mind, a lot of you might be thinking, well, how many of the statements that we've discussed in this talk are really new? Okay, in the sense that they can't just be reduced to some statements about invertible symmetries or anomalies. Like, how many of these are really about non-invertible symmetries? The common situation is actually the following. You start with your theory X, and you use non-invertible symmetries to make some non-trivial results about the IR physics. And then you pat yourself on the back and you say, oh, these non-invertible symmetries are so useful. This is great. But then it turns out that there was some topological manipulation phi that you could have done to get a new theory phi of X. And that new theory phi of X has only invertible symmetries or anomalies. And you can use those to make some IR statement that implies the original IR statement. In this sense, in this case, your original statement is not that interesting. It's still interesting, of course, but you know, it's not intrinsically non-invertible. You could have taken this more roundabout way with no non-invertible symmetries appearing and made the same statement. So what we want to do is we want to figure out when this can or can't happen. Okay. So in particular, we'd like to understand when topological manipulations phi, by this I mean something like stacking with SPT phases, discrete gaugings, etc. When these things can or can't be used to reduce non-invertible statements to invertible ones. Okay, and that's what I now want to tell you about for the simple duality defects. So the main tool that we'll use is the symmetry TFT. So the symmetry TFT is something with a fairly recent history, but for example, Gaiato-Culp, here at Perimeter, have this nice paper where they describe things. And the upshot, the basic idea, is that the symmetry TFT is a theory in one higher dimensions such that every topological manipulation of X corresponds to a topological boundary of the symmetry TFT. Okay, so this is the picture. You have the symmetry TFT in some slab, and you put it on the interval. So at one interval, you have some enriched Neumann boundary conditions. These are some boundary conditions that capture all of the dynamics of the theory X. And on the other boundary, you have some topological boundary conditions. You could have many of them labeled by some phi, say. And depending on which one you choose, when you reduce this thing on an interval, you'll get a d-dimensional theory, which is either X or phi X for every phi that you choose. Okay. So this is the basic physical idea. Let me tell you in slightly more math terms what this theory is in the bulk. If X is a theory which has categorical symmetry C, then the symmetry TFT is none other than Rashedikin-Taraev theory on the Drinfeld center of C. Okay? Or in other words, it's Taraev-Viro on C. If you don't know what that means, then I don't think I'm going to be able to explain it right now, but I'd be happy to do it afterwards. And No, sorry. And there's a very specific reason why I put your name here, and I'm going to say it right now, which is, so the reason that I put Theo's name here is that this thing is strictly true, or at least I understand it, in the 2D, 3D case, where it's a 2D theory and a 3D bulk. In higher dimensions, you have to make sense of the Drinfeld center of a higher category, and I don't personally know what that is, but it seems like Theo does because I saw those words in this paper. So this is why I put your name here. I'm sure many math people also know what this is, but I don't. So I'm going to give you a physics reinterpretation of this in higher dimensions. And then I would love to talk to mathematicians who know, who can tell me what I'm talking about. So yeah, so that's that. So OK, but I'm not going to really use these words. I would like somebody to explain to me how to do, you know, the higher categorical analog of RT of Z of C. So please, let's talk about it over coffee. OK. So anyways, if X has a just invertible symmetry G, and let's say that I have an anomaly, alpha, then it turns out that the symmetry TFT is just Digraph-Witten theory, with the action given by this Tuft anomaly, alpha, here. OK. So now let me repeat two things on this slide, which are going to be key. So first, I told you that there's the symmetry TFT such that every topological manipulation of X is a boundary condition of the symmetry TFT. Second, I told you that if the theory has only invertible symmetries, the symmetry TFT is Digraph-Witten. So now, going back to this question about intrinsic non-invertibility, we can do the following. Given a theory X with non-invertible symmetry, we ask, is the symmetry TFT a Digraph-Witten theory? If the answer is no, then we can conclude that there's no topological manipulation such that phi of X has only invertible symmetries, right? Because if there were, it would have to be Digraph-Witten. OK, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to take our theory, we're going to find the symmetry TFT, and just ask if it's Digraph-Witten or not. OK, so let's do that. I'm going to tell you now how to compute the symmetry TFT for these things from a nice physics perspective. So let's do it right now. I'm going to start in 2D. In 2D, you can ask, what is the symmetry TFT for a theory with fusion category being Tombari-Yamagami of Zn? This is the analog in higher dimensions of having this duality defect. OK? Now, of course, we know the answer in this case is this is Turiya-Viro on this Tombari-Yamagami. But I don't want to use that. I want to use a really dumb physics perspective. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to remember that this Tombari-Yamagami was built out of just Zn and then one non-invertible defect, remember? And I'm going to forget about the non-invertible defect. So I'm just going to consider Zn or Vec Zn. Okay, so let's start there. There, I know what the symmetry TFT is. It's just Zn gauge theory in the bulk. This is a theory we all probably know to some degree. At least it's obvious to see that this theory has n squared gauge invariant line operators, LEM. They're labeled by electric and magnetic charges valued in Zn. And the theory also, as it turns out, has a EM duality defect, such that when I move the electrically charged line through it, I get a magnetically charged one. I also know all of the topological boundary conditions for these things. They're classified by Lagrangian subgroups, which corresponds to choosing some subset of the lines to condense on the boundary. Either I can condense all of the electric guys and their buddies, or the magnetic guys and their descendants. Okay? So there's basically two choices here. Now, if I start with the electric boundary condition, the one where I've condensed L10 and its descendants, and I stack it with this EM duality surface, I'll get the magnetic boundary conditions. And conversely, if I end the defect perpendicular to this boundary, I'll get an interface between boundary conditions. And when I shrink, then what I'll do is I'll end up with an interface between the theory here and a Zn-gauged version of the theory. OK, this interface here is the thing that would become the non-invertible defect of Tombari-Yamagami if these things were self-dual. Right now it's an interface, but I need to make it a defect to get Tambari Yamagami on the boundary. And now there's an obvious way to do it. You see that I can make this thing into a defect, a well-defined defect in the boundary theory, if I gauge the E and M symmetry in the bulk. Because then this surface here becomes invisible, this is all the same stuff, boundary conditions are the same, and this will just be a defect. So in other words, the symmetry TFT for Tambari Yamagami is obtained from that of just VEC ZN by gauging the EM duality symmetry. And so now you just have to figure out what it means to gauge ENM duality symmetry, and now I have like one or two slides left, so let me just quickly tell you what that means. I won't give details, but ask me the details afterwards, please. So you start with this theory. This is the symmetry TFT for ZN, and I want to gauge the ENM duality symmetry. So to do that, first I'll rewrite the theory as a K-matrix theory. So I'll just put this into vector form here. So this is just a rewriting of the original thing. And now I couple to a background gauge field for ENM duality. That's the tricky part. But it turns out that this is done by promoting A to be a twisted cocycle. I'll tell you the details about this if you ask later. But anyways, you promote it to something called a twisted cocycle. You get some twisted cup product and twisted differential as well. And then, once you have this, you just gauge C by making it dynamical and adding some appropriate BF term to make this a well-defined Z2 gauge field. And it turns out that what I wrote here gives you precisely a Lagrangian description of Rushetikin-Tarayev theory on the Drinfeld center of Tambari Yamagami. So all of these nice things from these math papers, like they have all of the S matrices and T matrices and stuff, you can recalculate by just taking braiding of gauge invariant operators. And now I don't have any time, but you can do the same exact thing in 3 plus 1 dimensional case. You just lift A from a 1 cocycle to a 2 cocycle, and et cetera. You can again derive braiding matrices and stuff like that. And so it would be really nice to make connections between this and, for example, the stuff that will be in David Reuter's talk, where he'll tell us about the higher categorical analog of S matrices. That should presumably come from some analog of the Hopf-Link in higher dimensions. And so by taking our higher dimensional gauge invariant operators here and linking them, we have computed stuff. And it would be nice to match that with what you're going to tell us about. And one conclusion is that this, in general, is not digraphic. OK, so this is my last slide. So I've hopefully convinced you that non-invertible symmetries have a variety of applications, including showing that a theory has self-dualities, constraining RG flows, and finding new RG flows. And for the last of these, I had illustrated this by means of obtaining new 3D n equals 6 theories. So many of these applications give results which are demonstrably outside of the reach of invertible defects. And this can be shown using this symmetry TFT technology. And anyways, I think that this is an exciting time to be having a conference on the subject. So I look forward to hearing everybody else's talks. And thanks for listening to mine.
Great. Sorry. First, a quick question. At the beginning, you said that there are two ways to produce an invertible symmetry, this duality defect and this procedure when you have, let's say, mixed set of anomaly.
Right.
So, but of course, there are other ones like this this case when you have outer automorphism and you gauge the outer automorphism acting on one form symmetries.
Yes,
so
yes.
In this language, this third case is like the mixed set of anomalies is non-genuine, non-invertible symmetry for you. I mean, it's something that you can do topological manipulation to recast it in an invertible
symmetry. Okay, so yes, you're asking if in those situations I would classify it as intrinsically non-invertible?
Yeah.
I would say no. In fact, for example, all of the condensation defects, in some sense, are they're built out of invertible stuff.
Okay.
So even those, I would say, all of the statements you can make with them, you can probably also make with the invertible stuff. And so, yeah, I don't want to make it sound like intrinsically non-invertible is a good or no bad non-invertible symmetries, but yeah, I guess I would take those as being not intrinsically not invertible. The same goes for the anomaly. So if you start with anomalies and you gauge half of it, it's not intrinsically.
Okay, and another question is, so you said that whenever you have, that the symmetry can be recasted into an invertible one,
yes.
This symmetry TFT is Dyer-Witten.
Yes.
In the other cases, is this Shackling drive. But yes. if instead you have like two non-invertible symmetries, for which are intrinsically non-invertible, for which Shackling drive theory is the same, is it true that there are topological manipulations that you can do for going from one to the other?
You're asking if two theories have the same symmetry TFT?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, then yes, there is a topological manipulation you can do to go between the two.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
So Shuhang asks, there are choices of gauging Z2EM in 2 plus 1D labeled by H3 of Z2 with U1. Which choice gives you the symmetry TFT you want?
Good question. I think that both of them, so we've only chosen one choice, which is to put that to be trivial. But I think that you could include those. And I suspect that what you'll get are the different variants of Tombari Yamagami as a category. So there's, let me just say that so far we've only done it with the trivial.
Hi, yeah, so this symmetry TFT is defined to be this thing that has this nice property. And you gave us a recipe in the particular case of Tombari Yamagami.
Yes, yes.
But so this is, I wanted just to ask, this is something that's known to exist anyway. So you gave us a recipe for one example. In other situations, uh-huh. The symmetry TFT is known to exist?
Yes, yes, yes. It always exists, and it's always given, it's always given by the Drinfeld center, or the thing realizing the Drinfeld center of that thing, at least in 2 plus 1D, 3D in the bulk. In higher dimensions, again, as I said, I think it still exists, but somebody has to explain to me what a Drinfeld center of a higher category is, and I'm sure somebody in the audience can do it.
I see. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
So I have one question for you. Can this type of methods, all these duality defects are sort of in codimension one. Can you use it? Is there a sort of higher codimension version of duality defect?
Yes. So the higher dimensional versions are slightly less interesting, but they are still interesting. We have some examples in our paper in 3 plus 1D where we talk about lines, which are of that type. But in general, they're slightly less interesting because if you wanted to have higher codimension non-invertible defects, you could always just gauge some non-abelian symmetry, and you would get one. But the thing is that if you want a non-abelian symmetry, you have to be looking at zero-form symmetries. And when you do the gauging, the dual symmetry that comes out, which is non-invertible, it's non-invertible because it's basically rep of G, which has non-invertible fusion. But that thing is always going to be higher codimension, because you always had to start with the zero form guys. So in some sense, those ones, the higher codimension ones, are sort of dime a dozen, and it's really the codimension one ones which are the most interesting. But of course, they're all interesting. So the answer is yes, but the codimension one ones are more interesting. Yes. Hi. That's a good question. So the question, let me repeat the question. Yeah. So the question was, is there any way or strategy that one might think of obtaining non-invertible symmetries, which isn't just by gauging? And so there is a way. So if the question is starting from a theory with invertible symmetries, then there is a way. Like, for example, in this diagram, you could draw this web and then look for symmetries. And for example, the triality symmetry I showed you is not related to any invertible symmetry by gauging. So it's intrinsically non-invertible. Now, it of course involves a gauging in it, but it involves a gauging in a theory which only had non-invertible symmetries itself. And So, well, maybe it's best if I just show you this, but. Yeah, so well, what I want to say is that, for example, S sigma here, this came from a theory which only had invertible symmetries, you could think of it, because this SO3 minus theory has an S symmetry which is invertible, because I only have to do S tau. I don't have to involve sigma, which is the non-invertible piece. So in that sense, the S sigma here sort of descended from this invertible S tau in this theory. So it was not intrinsically non-invertible. But in contrast, if I look at this ST here, you can see that no theory here has an invertible ST symmetry. Like, I can't just take ST and then dress it with tau. I have to dress it with sigma also in every node here. So that means that every node here has a non-invertible like ST symmetry. And so this is intrinsically non-invertible. Not related to any invertible symmetry. Now, granted, it's non-invertible because of a gauging, but the gauging is between two theories, neither of which has an invertible symmetry. Yes?
I don't really understand the notion of intrinsically invertible or not invertible. For example, if we take the three-dimensional Dyckgraff-Witten theory for a non-abelian group, it has line defects that are not invertible.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. I'm talking about the boundary theory. So the boundary theory, which is realized, you're saying do non-abelian? So if I do Dyckgraff-Witten theory on a finite, on an abelian group, the boundary theory always has only invertible symmetry. Even though in the bulk in that case, you also only have invertible symmetries because you have Zn and then rep Zn, which is also Zn.
Well, I mean, even if I go down a dimension and replace the Dyckgraff-Witten theory by a two-dimensional finite gauge theory, which is essentially the group algebra of a finite group, I mean, a group algebra has units, has invertible elements, but typical element is not invertible, and those elements still act as operators, and those operators are very useful. In the symmetric group, you use them, you know, to make Young tableau and so on. I mean, quantum theories have algebras of symmetries, so they're not going to be invertible. So I'm not sure I understand the notion of what it means to say that, you know, it only has invertible symmetries.
I would have said that if this bulk here is of Dyckgraff-Witten type, then the boundary theory, the theory that I get upon compactifying this on an interval, will have a fusion category, which is vec g. Vec g, if I'm just talking about the topological operators in this theory, if g is an abelian group, even more generally, so it only has invertible defects, right? I'm not talking about the representations of g.
Well, but if G is...
group-like. So every two lines, so you have G, and then you have a bunch of lines which generate G, if we're in 2D. And those lines fuse in exactly the way dictated by G, by which I mean that G1 and G2 lines will just give me the G1, G2 lines. There'll be a unique fusion channel.
Yeah, okay. Well, in the picture there, those would be the lines that would be supported on this left boundary, if that's a Dirichlet boundary. But you could also have lines in the interior, and those are labeled by objects in the Drinfeld center.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, of course.
And those need not be invertible.
No. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yes, I agree 100% with that. But that's a statement about the bulk. I'm talking about intrinsic invertibility of the boundary in some sense. So if I were to restrict myself in D-1 dimensions, the question is there a topological manipulation I can do directly in D dimensions in this picture, such that all of the non-invertible symmetries here become invertible? Does that make sense?
That's okay. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
So I suggest, given the time, that we thank Justin for the wonderful talk and continue discussion over coffee.
Would you say that this is accurate?